It's Lars Larson. Thanks for listening to my podcast and for listening to The Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. Happy Monday and welcome to the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Pacific Northwest with honestly provocative talk radio every single day. You're invited to the conversation at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. I have to put in a call to the Secretary of State of Oregon. This bothers me so much. I'm going to talk about it in the commentary in just a moment, about the six children who died and about the one or two. We're not sure if it was one or both of them, but I have, you know, I suspect that the two women who were married, who adopted six children, murdered those children. And I'll talk about that. But here's my first concern. Would you like to find out if somebody screwed up and missed something that might have saved the lives of those children? Well, you're probably not going to be able to do it. And here's why. I just got a reply from the Department of Human Services. You know, that's the agency that keeps an eye on children, whether you're in a natural family, adoptive family, no matter what. That's the agency that is charged with the awesome responsibility that says, if you think something is going wrong with the kids, if the teachers or a doctor or a nurse or anybody else, one of the mandatory reporters or somebody who's not a mandatory reporter says, I think these kids are in trouble, as there were neighbors in Washington state who said, I think these kids are in trouble. One of them keeps coming to our door begging for food, saying his two moms are not feeding him. Now, if that was true, it would begin to sound a lot like some of the other really terribly frightening stories we've heard about families who coop their kids up, say they're doing homeschooling, and I'm a fan of homeschooling. But if you're doing it so that you can keep your kids from coming to the attention of the authorities. So I know that this family 4 years ago, the Hart family, was living in the state of Oregon. So I reached out to the Department of Human Services. Do you know what they told me? They said, we can't even admit to you that we worked with that family. To which, if I were talking to the administrator of DHS, I'd say, the family is dead. The mothers are dead. The children are dead. Who are you protecting by saying we can't talk about it? Now, you may say, well, it's what it says in the law. We got to follow the law. There is following the law, but you know, whether it's the law or the Constitution, you don't follow the law or the Constitution over a cliff. Now, that metaphor has been used before. In this case, you might find it especially pungent because these kids died by going over a cliff, apparently as their mothers, or one of them at least, accelerated a vehicle, we're told, to where the vehicle would have been going 90 miles an hour. They took the computer out of the car. The car was found at the bottom of the cliff, smashed upside down. Horrible, ugly scene. But now you have state agencies who are charged with making sure that kids are safe saying, yeah, we don't have to do that. We don't have to tell you anything. I would like to know, did these kids come to the attention of DHS? That would be one thing. If they never came to the attention of the state agency, there was nothing much the state agency could have done. Although you might have asked the question then, were the kids in school then? Did neighbors notice anything amiss and call in reports to the police or to the child welfare authorities? There were neighbors who did exactly that in Washington state. Unfortunately, the warning came far too late. So this family moves in 2013 to Washington state. 2014 moves to Washington state. They had become a bit famous because one young man, Devontae, had hugged a police officer during one of those protests that came after the Ferguson incident and Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. And there were all those anti-cop protests. So here's this tiny child who goes up and gives a cop a hug. And the kid looked upset, although at the time you thought maybe he's just overcome with emotion. Maybe there was trouble already there. I mean, I don't think things like this happen overnight. So what happens then? Well, these children end up dead. Now, in Washington state, questions will be asked, although since the first visit by state child welfare authorities was only a few days before the two women packed the kids into a vehicle and drove them to California and then apparently killed themselves and murdered these children. Apparently, there wasn't enough time to act on this. But I'd like to know what was going on in Washington, and sorry, in the state of Oregon, where they lived before. You may never find out. Now, I want to tell you, when they write these laws, I understand sometimes the laws are written with the best intentions. Why we have to protect these kids from ridicule and shame and all these things that might come with their information being released. But right now, the Hart family is dead. And Oregon child welfare authorities are saying, we don't have to tell the public anything. For all we know, the child welfare authorities in Oregon knew that there was trouble in that household and did nothing. And I would like to know that if it's true. For all we know, the family never had contact with child welfare in Oregon. And in that case, I'd like to know that as well. But if they screwed up badly, the only thing protected by that law on privacy is a bunch of bureaucrats in Salem who say, we don't want the public to know we screwed up on this one, if they did. And even if we didn't screw up, we're still not going to tell the public. Do you get the feeling sometimes that you're being treated like a mushroom? You know, kept in the dark and fed you know what? That's how you grow mushrooms. It's also how apparently you operate government. So, happy Monday. Welcome to the program. You want to sound off? Naysayers go first at 866-439-5277. Our email is talk@LarsLarson.com. Our Twitter, and this is the poll today, should schools simply give up and let kids carry and use cell phones? New York State is already, or City of New York is doing it now. We'll talk about that, and I'll give you more information on it. We will also talk about the latest dodge that's being used by accused criminals to avoid going to jail. And it's as simple as saying one short phrase. And the police don't take you to jail. They take you to the hospital and you get a nice comfy bed and a nurse and meals brought to you and all that. I'll give you that as well. We're going to talk to the police about that. And our service advisors at car dealerships subject to overtime. Believe it or not, it's a Supreme Court case decided today. We'll get to that as well. And your calls. But we always start this program with a certain amount of nonsense.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense, presented by the Ryan Group, where they guarantee to sell your house in 29 days or less, or they'll buy it. 29andgone.com.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish rapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
It's beginning to sound a lot like murder. I'm talking about the Hart family and the six children who appear to have been murdered by either one or both Jennifer and Sarah Hart. The two married women adopted half a dozen kids. At least one of the children, Devontae, became known around America and literally around the world after a picture of him hugging a police officer at an anti-cop Ferguson rally went viral. He's also the child the neighbors say would come and visit daily, complaining that the women who were his mothers were not feeding the children. But the women packed up the kids and left town just after CPS visited. 3 days later, their SUV went over a cliff and all on board died. Police say the SUV's black box showed the vehicle doing 90 miles an hour and accelerating when it reached the cliff's edge. No use of brakes. We should find out what Washington CPS knew and whether they could have done more, like an Amber Alert, even in that short period of time. Since the family lived in Oregon 4 years ago, it's also worth asking, what did the Oregon child welfare officials know? And now the grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now. Brought to you by Dan Jones Conveyor Trucks. Rock, granite, topsoil, or sand. Let Dan Jones Conveyor Trucks put it where you want it.
Well, the Daily Grill today, stupid on steroids is what I call this. Portland now has brand new neighborhood speed zones, not 25 miles an hour, but 20. And they say this will help us achieve what they call Vision Zero. I call it Intelligence Zero. Here's why. 30% of the accidents where people are either hurt or killed happen on neighborhood streets. If you've done the math, you wonder, well, Lars, where are the 70% of the accidents happening? Shouldn't we go after that? They're happening on the arterial streets. Yeah, the bigger ones, the arteries that run fast. Are they changing the speed limit there? No, they're changing it on the streets where 30% of the accidents happen instead of going after the streets where 70% happen. I call that stupid on steroids. Today's best email, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. Dan Newberry writes in, Lars, I want to give a shout out to a police officer on the Gladstone Police Department. My son, who's a junior in high school, and some of his track team have taken to tailgating after practice. In the high school parking lot, they're snacking and talking about upcoming meets and playing games and enjoying themselves. One of the games they've been playing is water pong. Yeah, you're right, water pong. Like beer pong, only they use water. Well, the other day, somebody saw the boys doing this. Figuring they were drinking, they called the police. When the officer showed up, he did not assume that they were up to no good. He engaged them in a lighthearted, official way. The boys responded respectfully but playfully. They asked the officer if he wanted to play a round. He participated. He actually joked that if he won, he got to tase someone. They laughed at the joke that it was. My son volunteered to be the subject. It was a perfect example of how police interaction with young people should go. Respectful and good-natured. My son told me about it the next day, saying it was the chillest experience with an officer he'd ever seen. I don't know the officer's name, but I want to recognize his professionalism in dealing with teenage boys. Thank you to Gladstone Police, son Dan Newberry. Back in just a moment. We'll get to your phone calls and your emails at 866-439-5277. That's 866-HEY-LARS or email talk@LarsLarson.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, I called it murder. What happened to those six children? I think they were murdered. Whether or not both of the mothers suicided or not, or was it just the one behind the driver's wheel of that SUV that went over the cliff, and we're told by the police, the black box saying 90 miles an hour. No matter what it was, those kids, I think, were murdered. So I'll ask you, do you agree that it was murder, or could you defend it by calling it something other than that? I also mentioned this story out of New York. The percentage of K-12 public schools that prohibited cell phone use was 66% 2 years ago, down from 90% in 2010. It sounds as though the high schools are starting to simply give up. They say the nation's largest school system, New York, is among those that have abandoned strict bans, which had some students paying a dollar a day to store their phones in specialty trucks parked nearby before heading into school. Mayor Bill de Blasio, boy, has he brought some bad things to New York, fulfilled a campaign pledge when he lifted the ban in 2015, saying it would help parents stay in touch with their children. Well, that's probably literally true. But do you think most of the kids are using their cell phones to stay in touch with mom and dad? Or are they using them to surf the internet, to waste time, to text or email or other social media with their friends? And do you think it's a distraction from school? Ordinarily, the schools will tell you, we don't allow anything that's distracting in school. And yet they're going to start, it seems, start allowing kids to take cell phones to class. That one doesn't make sense to me. To your calls now at 866-439-5277. Let's go first to Becky. Hey, Becky, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
On the SUV going over the cliff, I have a couple things that are bothering me. One, I heard that they maybe stopped and then accelerated over the cliff. I wonder how...
Would that matter?
Well, no, but it was intentional in that respect. They didn't just, like, happen to just meander over the side of the cliff. How they got eight people, they weren't little kids, in that SUV, for one, with luggage, was something that bothers me, because I have a hard time fitting five in my van of 13-year-olds.
Right.
Then I wonder if maybe they possibly killed the other three that they can't find over the in the ocean. It just seems like one of them would have surfaced with all that.
Do you know what I'm thinking, Becky? I hope, and this is just spitballing, but on the side of the cliff, one of the door panels from the door is there. If you were one of the older kids and you saw that mom was accelerating toward a cliff, do you think you might have tried to open the door and jump out? Do you think that perhaps if that vehicle went over the cliff with an open door, that you might have literally had kids, I hate to say it, but spilling out of that SUV? I'm just thinking go ahead.
And you wonder if they heard them talking ahead of time. Those kids were not little.
No.
You know, if they heard something in the car. And then another thing, it seems like the two moms are white. How much background check did they do? It looks to me like they only adopted black children. And did they possibly have something against them if they were...
Well, here's the thing where I can go with the evidence we do have, which is a crashed SUV and accelerating toward 90 miles an hour and all this that we're getting from the police. I have no indication that they had any antipathy toward black children. But how much of a background check? I don't think we're going to find out, because the social service agencies say, oh, we can't tell you. It's against the law to tell you. I think that only protects the government and the government folks who may have done their job perfectly, or they may have screwed up so badly that they were part of the reason those kids are dead. One or the other, but we may never know. I'm going to ask Dennis Richardson, the Secretary of State, will you investigate and can you pry the information loose? He has told me that he has been told no. Now, I think when you have somebody who has a formal constitutional mandate to do oversight of agencies and do audits, one of the most important audits he'd ever do would be the one to find out why those kids are dead today. Let's go to naysayer Kevin. Hey, Kevin, you know we love naysayers. What do you and I disagree about?
Yeah, hey, good afternoon, Lars. 99.9% of the time I agree with you, but not today. Hey, this Portland messing around with the residential speed limit from 25 down to 20.
Yeah.
I understand, you know, that your concern was the 70% of the accidents occur in the major arterials.
Yep.
But I would just assume that if they're going to mess with a speed limit sign in some type of extravagant experiment, it'd be in the residential areas, because our major thoroughways in the Portland metro area are already screwed up and slow enough. And then their other part of the thinking is that I think that a lot of the people that dodge across these really busy streets are just making idiotic decisions.
You and I agree on that. There are a lot of people, you know, who dodge across. They wear dark clothing. And all that. But here's the problem I see. They're trying to sell this as, we have a problem with people getting hit. So they pick the place where the least people are getting hit, and they say, you see, we've solved the problem by putting up 20-mile-an-hour speed limits, when, in fact, they've addressed the place where the fewest of those kinds of incidents happen. And I'm not suggesting they should slow the arterials down. Not at all. But I'm saying that what they're trying to do is persuade the public, look, I did something about it. Well, you know, if your wife comes to you and says, hey, there's a leak, and you say, well, I'll fix the place where it's leaking the least, and I'll leave the place where it's leaking the most alone, your wife would think you were crazy or insulting or a little bit of both. That's what I'm talking about. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you live on the Radio Northwest Network, and glad to get your phone calls and emails. You know, I want people to follow the law. And I want people who break the law to get caught. I want them to be taken into custody, charged with the appropriate crime. And then I want to see them get their day in court. And if they're guilty, I want to see them convicted. And I'm always amazed at how clever some of the bad guys can be in the ways that they get out of having to answer for what they've done. I'm joined now by Sergeant Chris Burley from the Portland Police. Sergeant, it's good to have you on the program. How are you?
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm well, thank you.
Well, I understand that the folks who get arrested by the police have now figured out a new dodge that allows them to not go to jail but end up with a nice comfy bed and a nurse.
Yeah, for the past year and a half, we've noticed an increase in the number of people that reportedly swallow some type of drug soon after being taken into custody.
Now, how often is that reported to have, and usually it's, they'll say, oh, I just swallowed some heroin. They've figured out this dodge. How often do you find out that they actually did swallow some heroin?
Well, the numbers I checked this morning, we're still trying to get those numbers. And some of the information is tough for us to get in general, because it could be potentially protected by HIPAA. But we are working with the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office, the Sheriff's Office, the Multnomah County Health Department, in hospitals, to figure out a method in identifying people that are fictitiously telling us that they are swallowing heroin so that they get out of going to jail.
Now, hold on a second. You know, Sergeant, you just made several good, solid conservatives drive off the road when you said it might be protected by HIPAA. So you've got some person who is accused of a crime, may well be guilty of the crime, who's figured out the dodge is, all I have to do is tell the officer, I just swallowed some heroin. I swallowed it because I was afraid of getting caught since I was about to be arrested. And he may be lying through his teeth. He goes to the hospital. He gets to spend maybe 36 hours, I'm told, in a nice hospital bed somewhere, probably handcuffed to the bed, but whatever. And then at the end of that, even if he lied to you, that he gets away with it because you and the public can't find out if he was lying, because the information about whether or not his gut was full of heroin or nothing is protected by HIPAA?
Well, so I think you raised a couple really important points there. So we're seeing that people are averaging on a minimum of 6 hours in the hospital for this type of, you know, saying this happened. We recently, the other day, had officers and a suspect at jail for over 60 hours. So it's taking up an enormous amount of time. And then the last point, as far as being able to get that information, whether or not a person was not telling the truth, is why we're in conversation with the district attorney's office, the city attorney's office as well, to figure out how can we get that information. Is it going to require a warrant to get access to their medical records? But it's definitely something where the police bureau recognizes that it's a problem. People must be held accountable. People have identified that it's a loophole and they're taking advantage of it, and it's pulling a really limited resource that we have, police officers that should be going out and, one, answering 911 calls for service and out proactively policing, which is becoming more and more difficult for us to do with the resources we have. And instead, they're sitting in a hospital room, taking up a hospital bed and taking, money from other people that could be, that really need the medical services.
And you're staffing an officer with them the whole time, because then they have to walk them down to the men's room or the ladies' room, right?
Yeah, and because they're in our custody. And since they're in our custody, we can't give that to, you know, a non-law enforcement agency such as hospital security. It's the police have to stay with the person if we're going to keep them in custody to introduce them into the Multnomah County Jail.
Now, obviously, the fear is that if somebody really, truly did swallow a quantity of heroin and you take them to the jail, if the balloon pops or the baggie pops, then they end up dead as a result of that, or maybe seriously ill in some way, right?
Yeah, that's correct. We don't want to see anybody be injured or die because they did, you know, ingest something that's dangerous or
not. Not even foolish heroin thieves or heroin dealers?
Yeah, exactly. We don't want anybody to be injured or become sick or die because of this. We want to, you know, it's important that we preserve life, but we also recognize that there's a fair number of people that are not swallowing drugs and are able to try and use this as a loophole to get out of going to jail.
Sergeant, couldn't we use the social Darwinism loophole that says if somebody is stupid enough to be a drug dealer and stupid enough to swallow the drugs, then, hey, you pay your money and you take your chances. There's no social Darwinism loophole?
Well, the police bureau respects human life, and, you know, we are not advocates of people, you know, trying to get out of going to jail, but we're never going to do something that's going to jeopardize a person's life. We're not going to second guess whether or not it's happened. We leave the assessment, the medical assessment, up to the medical professionals, and that's what we'll continue to do as we work with the Multnomah County Health Department, the Sheriff's Office, and the DA's office to figure out how we can close this loophole, hold people accountable when they are, you know, not telling the truth. They're using up limited police resources and hospital resources.
And as you said, Sergeant, since they're in custody, who's paying the hospital tab?
So that can be up to the city and the county, the hospital, Medicare, Medicaid.
But routinely, if you have somebody in custody, their medical care is on the city or the taxpayers tab one way or the other, right?
That's correct.
So yeah. We get to pay for them to go to an unnecessary hospital visit. We get to burn up a lot of officer time babysitting them. And then do they end up going back to jail at that point?
Well, so that's one of the things that we have to take into account. What we're seeing right now is that if a person is arrested on a minor charge, let's say a minor property crime, a theft charge, oftentimes what we're doing is recognizing that we don't have enough officers out on the street right now to respond to 911 calls for service in as quickly, as a timely fashion as we'd like. And so those persons may receive a citation where they would otherwise go to jail. But for maybe a felony warrant or a person-to-person crime, we're definitely going to have an officer stay with that person until the hospital releases them to go to the jail.
So if enough people start doing this, nobody goes to jail, right, Sarge?
Yeah, and so that's what we're trying to figure out. How can we close this loophole? What can we do to work with our partners to address this problem, hold people accountable, and make it so it's not appealing to, get out of jail by feigning that you, swallowed something that you didn't swallow?
Is there any other crime that you can charge them with that will up the ante? Say, if you're lying to me and we take you off to the hospital and it turns out that you didn't actually swallow something, we're going to take you back to jail, except you're going to face some more charges. But are there any that are, I know it's illegal to lie to the federal officers, but unfortunately it's not illegal to lie to the cops, is it?
Well, so what we're, in the early conversations with multiple groups about the possibility of maybe some type of fraud to the hospital. If you're going in there into the hospital under false pretenses and using services, and then you're not paying for them, like you said, you're using the taxpayers' money. Is that some type of fraudulent activity? Have you participated in some type of fraud? So we are looking into that as a possibility.
How about obstruction of justice? Is this obstruction of justice when you are deliberately, carrying out a fraud on the police officer in the attempt to keep him from doing with you, which what should happen is you go to jail? Is that obstruction of justice?
Well, I think that that's something that, some of the precinct commanders, as they continue the conversation with the district attorney's office as to whether or not that would fit the criteria of, obstruction of justice. It's really, a tightrope to walk because of just, that when the law was created, I don't know that, people thought that that there would be people amongst us that would go to this length to try and get out of jail.
Sergeant Burley, I appreciate it. Anything else going on at the Bureau today we should ask you about?
No, we're just reminding people that the 20-mile-per-hour speed limit is now taking effect. And as part of Vision Zero, we just encourage people to drive safely and slowly in the neighborhoods.
Now, you're really going to be full-on enforcing that one?
We understand that it's a change. There's still signage up that has 25 mile per hour speed limits in some areas. And so the change is still coming. So we right now are really focusing on the educational component, but it is 20 miles per hour is the speed limit within residential areas in the city of Portland now.
Very good. Sergeant Burley, it's a pleasure to have you on. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Lars.
You betcha. That's Sergeant Chris Burley with Portland Police. Can you imagine this, Dodge? I mean, I think that some of these criminals are so inventive. If they just turn their attention to actually living under the law like the rest of us, they might actually get ahead. Instead, they figured out clever ways to avoid jail, and it costs you and me a lot of money. Back in just a moment. It's Monday, and glad to have you with me on the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I never once thought that when I took my car in to get it repaired and I talked to a service advisor, and I've got a good one at the Ford dealership for my Exploder because it doesn't have many problems, but when I do have a problem, I want to be able to go to the dealership and get it fixed. I never thought that the issue of how much service advisors at car dealerships get paid would be a Supreme Court case, but the U.S. Supreme Court has made a decision about service advisors. This one actually involves some at a Mercedes-Benz dealership in Encino, California. Here's what was going on. For decades, service advisors did not get overtime pay. Why? Because that's the way the law read. You didn't get overtime pay. And then along came that B. Hussein Obama. Remember, he was president for 8 years and wrecked the country. He decided, no, we're going to make sure that service advisors at Mercedes dealerships get overtime pay. So he went in and they started interpreting the law differently. Well, that one finally made its way up to the Supreme Court, which made its decision and announced it today and said that because you're a salesman, you're selling service, so therefore you don't get overtime pay. As Clarence Thomas, one of my favorite justices, wrote in the majority opinion, the ordinary meaning of salesman is someone who sells goods or services, and service advisors do precisely that. Of course, on the dissenting, the losing end of things, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, boy do I wish she would retire, wrote that because service advisors neither sell nor repair automobiles, they should not be exempt from overtime payments. Anyway, three decades of the law being enforced the right way, 7 years of it being enforced the wrong way because of Barack Obama, who didn't actually believe in the law, and now we're back to doing it by the law again. To your calls at 866-439-5277. Josh, you heard me talking to Sergeant Burley about these criminals who are accused criminals who are arrested, and then they lie to the cops and say, I swallowed heroin, and they get a trip to the hospital instead of a trip to jail. What do you make of that?
Well, Lars, glad to be with you. I've lived in Portland for 3 years, and I come from Nevada. And in Nevada, if they pulled a stunt like that, they catch a new charge, and it's a felony for destroying evidence.
Oh, that's a good...
If we did that here, yeah, I believe if we did that here, it might knock off some of this behavior.
Well, it might. That's a good idea. Now, they said they're considering whether they can call it fraud or theft of services because they're committing a financial fraud. If they're not truly sick, it still costs money to go spend 6 hours or a day in the hospital, and apparently as long as 2.5 days. That's a good idea. I think that'd be a great way to approach it. Maybe they should.
Yep.
Hey, Josh, thanks very much. I appreciate the call. Let's go to Steve. Hey, Steve, you had a thought on these heroin stealing, or sorry, swallowing criminals. What do you say?
I understand that most of the jails do have medical personnel on staff, like an RN that, you know, distributes medications to people that are in there for 6 months. Why wouldn't that person be able to monitor the person that supposedly swallowed drugs? And if something should start to materialize, then call 911 and have an ambulance.
Well, I think I can tell you why, Steve. Not being a lawyer or a doctor or a nurse myself, but here's what I'm thinking. If you had a little baggie or one of those glassine packets of heroin and you swallow it, and you're totally okay till the thing dissolves, and then all of a sudden a gigantic, I mean, for heroin is, you know, dosed out in small quantities. So you got this giant amount of heroin in your gut, and there's no quick way to get it out. I mean, if it's in your stomach, they could pump your stomach. But if they put that inmate in a cell and say to the nurse, keep an eye on him, the second that stuff dissolves and the heroin goes into your system, and remember, even if they run you to the hospital at that point, they have no way to get it quickly out of you, what's that?
It's a bad deal for the guy that swallowed it.
Yes, it is. And I think what they would say, what they're saying is, if the guy dies in custody because he swallowed heroin and it was his heroin and he decided to swallow it, but the police don't take him to the hospital and he doesn't have a crowd of doctors around him who can, you know, I guess give him Narcan to temporarily counteract the heroin and all that, then all of a sudden the taxpayers and the cops become responsible for this idiot's death. And so yep. I think that I understand why they're trying to avoid it. And I think that if you had an on-call nurse or an on-duty nurse at the jail, and the guy says all of a sudden, my gut, and starts screaming that, you know, the heroin is, you know, the balloon is burst in his gut or whatever, you probably don't have the 5 minutes for the ambulance to get there, the 5 or 10 minutes for it to get to the hospital. That guy may be dead very quickly. And at that point, you've got his family maybe playing for the lawsuit lottery. Thanks for the call. Playing the lawsuit lottery saying, our poor loved one who is just a good, honest, undocumented pharmaceutical salesman on the streets. You owe us $1 million or $2 or $3 million, and we get to get rich because our friend, our family member, was a heroin dealer. You got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Happy Monday to you, and welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. Your calls are welcome to, and naysayers to the head of the line at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. On our Twitter poll, found online, at Lars Larson Show on Twitter, LarsLarson.com on the web. Should schools simply give up and let kids carry and use cell phones? My answer to that would be absolutely not. They are a complete distraction during class time. I mean, if the kids could limit their use to passing time and during the lunch hour, that's fine. But if they have them in the classroom, I don't see how the teacher gets anything done. On Friday, we asked you the following. Should Kate Brown fish or cut bait, veto the $1 billion tax hike, or sign it? It's sitting on her desk. She was hired to be the governor, which means you make decisions. You don't do anything else of any particular value. You simply make some of the biggest decisions. Here's a decision, Kate. You've got a bill sitting on your desk. If you sign it, it's going to peel $1 billion out of the pockets of small business here in the Northwest over the next couple of years. If you veto it, it's going to leave that money in those pockets so that businesses can expand and hire more people and grant raises and everything else. Can you please make a decision? For the life of me, I do not understand why we want people in public office who beg to have the job. They raise millions of dollars to win the job. They go out on the campaign trail for a year and a half to get everybody to keep them in the job. And then once they're in the job, be like the NBA paying players who show up and then can't shoot the ball, can't pass the ball. Kate Brown can't shoot the ball. If she can't shoot the ball, she shouldn't be in the job. Anyway, here calls at 866-439-5277. Oh, the answer on Friday. 92% of you joined me in saying veto the bill. 4% said sign it. 4% said stay on the fence because she can't make a decision. And just look who just walked into the studio. This is the head of the United States Selective Service. He is himself former state senator Don Benton. Senator, and what do I call you? The administrator of the Selective Service, right?
Actually, it's director.
Oh, sorry, but director.
Don works fine.
Now, which one ranks higher, an administrator or a director in Washington, D.C. terms?
Depends. They're both appointed by the president. I suppose it will make a difference depending on how big the organization is.
Now, do you have your presidential appointment on the wall frame? Because if I ever got appointed to something, I think I'd hang that thing on the wall.
I do.
You do?
I do.
All right.
And I never forget the day it came, the general counsel.
Does it arrive with some special messenger, or
well,
is it just...
It did in this case. The general counsel came running into my office one day and said, "Did you see him? Did you see him?" And I said, "Who?" And he said, "The White House messenger." And I said, "No, I didn't see him." And he said, "Oh, he dropped this off, and he's got this tube in his arm." And he said, "Have you ever seen one of these?" And I said, "I don't think so. What is it?" He said, he called it your parchment. It's your parchment. "Oh, can we open it?" I said, "Well, sure, open it." So he opened it and rolled it out on the desk, and it was signed by the president and by Rex Tillerson, both.
It is a piece of parchment.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
So we had it nicely framed, and of course it's hanging on the wall right behind my desk. You bet.
So are we
very proud of it?
Are we ready to start the draft again? You've got all the
well,
ducks in a row.
You know, we will always be ready if the country needs us. That's the objective and the mission of the agency, is to be ready, be prepared. Let's knock on wood and hope we never need it.
Agreed.
Okay, but if we do, the American people are going to be very happy that we have this rather inexpensive agency that is working away behind the scenes to make sure that the men and women of the armed services are backed up if there's ever a national crisis. And that's the critical piece of it. It's kind of funny, you know, Lars, I started out in business in the insurance industry, and it seems I'm in the insurance business again, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Your insurance that you hope never pays off, like life
exactly
insurance
that.
Or fire or flood. You don't ever want to call on it, but it has to be there.
Last time I saw you, my friend, you were visiting the swamp yourself.
I was. I was, you know, going. We went to the White House. We had a good time. We did the first ever broadcast from the East Room, and we got a chance to talk to the president, and it was very interesting.
It was cool having you there. I tell you, I'm very proud to work for the man. Everything that you can throw at him has been thrown at him. Mm-hmm. I mean, everything.
And his approval ratings are going up, even with all these darts being thrown at him.
And God bless him. His stamina, his endurance, he's like a Timex, you know. He takes a licking and he keeps on ticking, and he just keeps going and going. And what's he do? He just keeps fulfilling campaign promises. Every time you turn around, there's another one done and another one done. It's amazing. In my lifetime, I've never had a president that kept his promises from the campaign like this guy has.
That's one that we really have to be singing the praise of going to fall. And you know what I'd like? I'd like one campaign ad to just be a photo, a current photo of William Jefferson Clinton, right next to a photo, same current photo of Donald Trump, and say, which one looks like he can make the country healthier? Because Bill Clinton is looking pretty rough these days. Now,
I the presidency takes a toll on people. There's no question about that.
Doesn't seem to take a toll on Donald Trump. He's hale and hearty.
Like I said, he's the greatest multitasker I've ever known. I saw him in the hotel room. We visited with him. He called for myself to come and see him during the convention. We were up and saw him. He was dealing with six or seven different issues at the same time. Also watching, flipping between Fox and CNN, seeing what was on the news. I mean, multitasking, this guy knows how to do it. Incredible business mind, can settle, you know, really tough problems, boom, 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 very quickly, and deal with them all at the same time and just keep going and also think about, you know, what's being reported on television at the same time. It's an amazing honor to work for somebody so talented.
Don Benton is the director of the Selective Service, as you said, a small agency. How small is it, and how much, you're a conservative, how much smaller can you make it?
Well, it's interesting because that's the first thing you think of. You know, you go in, we're gonna cut, we're gonna whack, we're gonna save money, we're gonna do this, we're gonna do that, and you get there and you realize that that agency has not had a budget increase, not a dollar increase in their budget since 1983.
Really?
It's
wow.
It's still operating on the same allocation. Now, we've gone from 750 reserve force officers to 175, and from 6 regional offices to 3. And so did it need to be done? I don't know. We're still operating. Does it need some
Are you
tender,
missing anything
care?
Big right now?
Yeah, well, look, we need to modernize. We're having a tough time with the president's executive order on modernization because modernization, when you haven't done anything like that in 40 years, costs a lot of money. There's just no question about it.
Even though buying computers today compared to buying computers even 20 years ago, I remember what I paid for my first my first PC that was it's a boat anchor today by today's standards. I could have bought 2 or 3 laptops for that today.
We had an outreach contract for about $700,000. I was able to terminate that within about 30 days of my appointment. That's an expertise that I have that we don't need to be paying somebody else for.
Yeah.
Right. I think we can do a better job in-house, and it hasn't cost us anything to bring that function in-house. So we've already saved $700,000. But computers and hardware is not the expensive part of the computers and the IT. It's the programming and the software and the development and managing this database. We have the third largest database in the federal government. And so managing that, controlling that, tracking that, you know, sending letters to that, it's a major undertaking, especially when you're dealing with, you know, old types of programming. We're talking COBOL and Fortran and, you know.
Holy cow. Translating the data over would be expensive.
Yeah, it's very old software, very old systems. They're still working. We've kept them working. But eventually we're going to need to transition to new systems.
Is there anything off the shelf where some other agency or even a private company does something similar enough that they could say, we could take this piece of software that's already being used by, and I'm trying to think what private sector company might have to do what you do, which is...
There's a government agency that does exactly what we do.
No, you know what they're going to do.
And they do it all the time. You know who it is?
Who?
The Census Bureau. Huh? They balloon up to over 200,000 employees every 10 years, and then they shrink back down again. And so they've got a model for exploding into action and then shrinking back again. And I think we can learn a lot from them.
Okay.
And so I've made some outreach efforts to try to do some visits over there and see what they're up to and see how they spool up in terms of the HR. How do you spool up to 200,000 employees and have the competent managers to manage those people? And you're only giving them part-time jobs.
Well, half of those people are trying to figure out how they can ask the citizenship question. You know that. They're all like, oh, no, we can ask you how many toilets you have and how far it is to work and whether you get there in a car, or on a horse, or on a bicycle, but we can't ask if people are citizens.
Well, just ask it. You know, I had a very simple bill, you may remember, when I was in the Senate that required the folks at the motor vehicle office. I said, if you're going to register people to vote when they get their driver's licenses, which is, you know, not a bad idea, but you need to verify that they're not here from some foreign country, getting a driver's license for 6 months and then leaving. We don't want to register those people to vote.
Right.
So simply ask, are you a U.S. citizen before you know, have them sign on the motor voter registration? And oh my goodness, I was called every name under the sun for wanting to make sure that people were citizens before we registered them to vote. I thought it was a simple question.
Apparently
I was
not.
Wrong.
Don, let me just for some fun stuff. Because you know that you don't have the sexiest agency in the world, but I want to know.
That's true.
What are you doing with the pronoun people, and what are you doing with the people who think that they were a young man and now they are a young lady? What are you doing with that category of people in selective service?
The rules are clear. The law is clear for us. And we have, there have been no new laws passed, and we've been given no new direction. So we follow the law the way it was written and the way it was passed, and it requires males to register when they turn 18 based upon their birth certificate data. So if you were born a male, you're required to register. Now, if you go back to court, some judge changes your birth certificate and your birth certificate says something different, then that's what we have to go by. We go by what the birth certificate says, and that's the way the law is written, and that's what we have to do, and that's how we handle it.
How about the pronouns? The folks who say, I'm neither male nor female.
It goes by what it says on your birth certificate. Good. And if the birth certificate says that you were born a male, if you don't have a judge's order to change that, then you're required to register, and that's the law.
And it's I know, Don, somebody's going to ask, although you've already told me the answer before, if you're here illegally and you are male, 18 to 26, what happens?
You have to register.
Even if you're here illegally,
even
you
if
have
you're
to
here
register.
Illegally, because if you apply for citizenship and they ask you, how long have you been here, and you were here during the appropriate time and you didn't register, it will automatically put your citizenship application on hold for 5 years. Okay, so it's very important for immigrants that want to become legal citizens to understand that one of the pieces to that is registering for the Selective Service. You can do that at sss.gov. There, we do not share information with Homeland Security. We don't even keep a record.
Although you should.
Well, there's no way for us to even know. Lars, if you look at our data file, you can't tell by looking at it whether someone is a citizen or not.
If I cross-matched it with the Social Security database, I would.
Well, likely you could if you cross-matched it with other databases.
Mm-hmm.
But we are in the business of registering people for the Selective Service. That's what we do, and that's what we focus on. And we don't want anybody to be afraid to register with us because of some other reason. We want them to register for the reason that the law was passed, and that is to let this nation know that you're ready, standing by. If your nation needs you for all the rights and privileges you're enjoying, you're ready to stand up and defend the nation if it calls you.
Don, thank you very much.
It's always great to be here. I've got something special I want to do for you. You want to wait until after the break?
Yeah, we'll do it after the break.
I got a surprise for you.
Don Benton is with me. Thank you, Don. Don Benton is with me, the director of the Selective Service. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, I can't resist a surprise, and Don Benton is here, former state senator from the state of Washington, now director of the Selective Service, and Kirby Wilbur wanted me to give you his best as well because he didn't get a chance to see you in person, but you said you have a surprise.
Kirby and I go back a long ways. He was he was my choice when I was state party chair. He was my choice to be the chairman for the state convention. He ran that convention that year.
He's a good man.
Listen, I came home this weekend for Easter, spent some time with the family, and since I was headed back out here, I thought I might have an opportunity to see you. And so I talked it over with my staff, and we have decided to award to you, Lars, our Honored Patriot Award. We give this award out. The Selective Service gives the Honored Patriot Award out to, well, all kinds of people, movie stars and secretaries and governors, admissions clerks who help us with all of our presidential appointments at the state level. But we've decided that you've earned this. And let me just read to you what the award says.
All right.
The Selective Service System presents to Lars Larson its Honored Patriot Award, presented to the Emmy and Peabody Award-winning radio personality for his support of the Selective Service System. Mr. Larson provided invaluable service to this agency by using his renowned radio show, The Lars Larson Show, as a platform to increase awareness of Selective Service registration and the many benefits associated with that requirement. His willingness to advance peacetime Selective Service registration reflects a deep sense of his patriotic values and public service. He has made a positive difference for our agency, for the young men of the United, and for the United States of America. On behalf of the United States Selective Service, it's with great pride that I present to Lars Larson the Selective Service Honored Patriot Award.
I appreciate it, Don. Thank you very, very much. We're going to get a picture with that. Thank you very much. That is very nice of you.
Isn't that cool?
Yeah. That's very cool. It's a lot of fun. I believe in it. Look, I think we may never need it, But this won't be the kind of thing you want to try and lash up together at the last second if we ever do.
You got to be ready. And that's the big thing. And you have helped us pass the word. And we need help from you and others like you. People always say to me, oh, my gosh, I didn't know it was still the law. Yes, it is still the law. When you turn 18 years old, you must go to SSS.gov and register for the Selective Service. I know it's amazing, but it is still the law.
Well, and there are people who miss out on student loans and federal jobs and a lot of things if they haven't done what's re- and it's not much. Register, you're done.
45 seconds, literally, on the website, and you're done.
I'm glad to hear you can do it on the website with all those old computers of yours.
That was the very first thing we started. We want to make it easy.
When you took over, they didn't have a website?
No. We had a website. We never collected emails.
What?
I know. I'm the first director of the Selective Service to order the collection of email
Was
addresses.
That a Hillary thing, not keeping the emails?
I don't know why, but it was amazing to me that they didn't collect emails.
I don't know if I trust a guy who doesn't collect emails, because that's a Hillary.
We're doing it now.
Thanks for what you do at Selective Service. I appreciate it. That's Don Benton with us, former state senator from the state of Washington. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to be with you and glad to take your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. You know that April is the national month of the military child. Now, I was a military child. I understand the sacrifice. My mom was in the United States Navy from 1940 to 1945, and then she was out. She was a nurse. I was born about 14 years later, and she was still married to my dad, who was in the United States Navy. He did his 21 years, and then he got out. But before he got out, I was born. My mom had to go all the way to the other side of the planet, to what they then called Formosa. It's now called Taiwan, to be with my dad. And then later, of course, I'm married to Tina, and Tina's son, Brandon, my stepson, went into the United States Marine Corps. And I know what it's like, even if your son or daughter is serving and they're not in an area where bullets are being fired at them, there is still a sacrifice that is made by both the children of and the parents and the other family members of those who serve our country. So I've invited Haley Hartwick on, who's a former scholarship recipient of Fallen Patriots. She has a passion for giving back. She served as a TAPS volunteer, Freedom Alliance intern, and housing intern at the Family Abuse Center in Waco, Texas. Haley, good to have you on the program. Thanks for taking the time today.
Well, thank you for having me, Lars. I appreciate it.
Tell me about the Fallen Patriots Foundation and how we can help out this organization and how it helps out the military children out there.
So Children of Fallen Patriots Foundation is a foundation that gives scholarships or college scholarships to children who have lost a parent in the line of duty. And one way that you can help out is just raising awareness. So if you know any Gold Star families in the area, please send them to our website, which is www.fallenpatriots.org, where they can fill out an online enrollment form and we can get their information to get them on scholarship as soon as possible. And then another way that you can help is just spreading the word about Fallen Patriots. We do lots of campaigns, especially around Memorial Day, and see how everybody can get involved to support these families.
Well, and in fact, Fallen Patriots hasn't been around all that long, since what, 2002, but you've done $21 million worth of scholarships to benefit how many kids?
We have benefited over 1,000 kids at this point, which is amazing. And then, like you said, $21 million in scholarships.
And where do you find most of your donations? Is it coming from other folks who've served in uniform, or are you getting it from corporations, or what?
It's a variety. You know, sometimes it's private donors, sometimes it's corporate sponsors, and it's a lot of people that want to give back in a way that, especially if they haven't served but want to contribute to the military in some way, this is a very special way for them to give back.
Because one of the numbers you have to appreciate is right now there are 2 million children whose parents serve in the military right now. And of that 2 million, about 20,000 have lost a parent in service to our nation. So the work of Fallen Patriots is just starting.
Exactly. We have a thousand students on scholarship with us who have benefited from Fallen Patriots, and we're still trying to find that 19,000.
Yeah, and why is it hard to find them? I mean, I guess is the government set up to be able to tell you? Because you would think that somewhere in a giant database in Washington, D.C., there'd be a list of every young man or woman whose parent has given his or her life in the service to his country. You'd think it'd be relatively easy to find them.
Yes, you think it'd be relatively easy. Sometimes it can be challenging, but that's what we're calling everybody out for, is to see how we can find these students and how we can get them on board, because we're more than willing to help and want to be there, not only to provide educational support, but emotional support as well.
So what'd you do with your scholarship?
So I attended Baylor University in Waco, Texas, and my background is in social work. And thanks to Fallen Patriots, I was actually able to graduate from college debt-free, which was one of my father's dreams, because he paid his way through college and wanted his children to graduate debt-free.
Would you mind saying a few words about your dad?
Yes, absolutely. So my father was Chief Warrant Officer Michael Hartwick, and he was an Apache helicopter pilot, loved flying ever since he was a little boy. He always wanted to fly, and so he truly died doing what he loved, and he lost his life serving in Iraq in 2006. Actually, the 12-year anniversary was yesterday on Easter, so it was a very bittersweet day for me, but it was also a day where I could reflect on his wonderful life and all that he sacrificed.
Absolutely. God bless him. But that's part of what's tough. How old were you when he was in the service and flying?
So I was 10 years old when he was killed, and my brother was 6 years old, so very young age. And my mom, you know, was left as a single mother having to raise these two young children. And that's where Fallen Patriots was such a blessing to my family, because she was able to enroll us at that age in the Fallen Patriots system, so that when I reached college age, Fallen Patriots could come and say, your college is covered. You know, we are here to assist you. And saying that to a single mother who has lost everything that she loved and cherished, that's amazing. It leaves these families breathless.
Yeah, I'll bet it does, because I was going to ask, at two, I imagine the weight wasn't nearly as tough on you as it was on your older brother. That dad was overseas, that he was on the other side of the planet, you couldn't see him all the time, but there'd still be an effect. You know, when dad or mom is serving overseas, even if they don't give their life, it's still really tough on families.
Mm-hmm. It's a family effort, you know. It's not just one person serving, it's the whole family. And there's sacrifices that come with it, whether you lost your life or father or mother comes home. It's really a family effort, and that's kind of the atmosphere that we create at Fallen Patriots, is that, you know, these families don't need to do life alone. Like, we're here to support them, and kind of have almost created a Fallen Patriots family ourselves.
Now, what are you doing these days? What are you doing with that degree?
So I was able to combine both my passion for serving others and the military community, and now I joined the Children of Fallen Patriots team this past June as a scholarship administrator, and then am able to work on more of the donor relations side as the development administrator for Fallen Patriots.
So that means when people reach out, they're reaching out right to you, and you can hook them up with the skill, the services, and it may be a mother or father, maybe a grandfather or grandmother who says, well, you know, my granddaughter's or grandson is affected by this, they can reach right out to you.
Exactly. They can. They can reach out directly to me, and I know exactly what they've been through being a Gold Star child myself. And that's what's so special about Fallen Patriots. It's that we have lots of veterans and lots of Gold Star children working on staff, so that we are able to connect to our families.
All right. I'm talking to Haley Hartwick, who's a former scholarship recipient or a recipient from Fallen Patriots. What are the website and other social media for this?
Yes, there is. It's at Fallen Patriots, pretty much on all our websites, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. You'll be able to find us.
Very good. Haley, it's a pleasure to have you on, and thank you for the service of your father. We all appreciate it, and thank you for the time today.
Well, thank you so much, Lars. I appreciate it.
Good to have you on the program. That's Haley Hartwick, who is one of the beneficiaries. If you know a child out there, and it may be that mom or dad, you know, if a mother or father has passed away in the service to their country and they're eligible for this, you want to make sure that every single child gets hooked up to that program. And we're glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I told you about that accident that they've been calling an accident since it happened, taking the lives of two women from Longview, Washington. Woodland, Washington, and the lives of six children, their six adopted children. I've been telling you that I think this is something they did deliberately. Over the weekend, the information developed that it now appears that that vehicle was deliberately driven over the edge of that cliff. The police are continuing their investigation, but there are folks who have a different opinion on it. Alan is on the line. Alan, why did you call in again? Tell me what you told my producers.
Well, I was concerned whether or not, or two parts of it, with the state not releasing information, saying that it was privatized and because of they may have been in the system. Well, that they can cover up part of that, but the state isn't good about half the stuff they're supposed to be doing. My concern is that when this accident happened, these people were being tracked. How many times did they use the phone, and how many times did somebody not check where the phone conversations, if everybody can do that? Seems like they do it to all the people that are really trying to make a difference and not the people that are screwing up. But why can't they follow that all the way to where it was? Maybe those three kids or one kid or however many, if they haven't been found yet, or their bodies, where are they at? Maybe they took them into the woods and turned them loose there and said, hey, fend for yourself, or to a park, or somebody else may have tried to help them.
I do Occam's razor in a case like this. I look for the most obvious explanation, and it's usually the right one. I think that those three kids were in the vehicle. They may have tried to get a door open as they realized that their two mothers were about to kill them. Or at least one of them was about to kill them, and they may have tried to get out of the vehicle, but I think it was too late, and I think they are also deceased. I think they're also dead. As for them being tracked, remember that the state of Oregon will not tell us whether or not Human Services had any contact with this family. We also won't be able to find out how thorough was the background check on the women before they were allowed to adopt six kids, which is one kid is a gargantuan responsibility. Six is an overwhelming responsibility. But when they moved to Washington State and the neighbors called CSD or CPS and said, hey, we think these kids may be in trouble, CPS had barely had contact with them. So when you say they could have tracked them by phone or cell towers, you're assuming that they were being tracked like they were, you know, runaway serial killers. They weren't. At that point, as far as we know, CPS had had contact with them 3 days before they went over the cliff. They hadn't even talked to the women or examined the situation. So there would have been no reason to have them tracked the way you'd track, like I said, a serial killer. All they knew was that they had disappeared. They weren't answering their door. Their car was gone. The kids were gone. What they didn't know was where they had gone, and you're not suggesting that for every single case involving children that you would immediately start tracking people by cell phone and other means. I think the women packed up their rig and packed up the kids and left, and that they at some point decided we will take, you know, either both of them or one of them said we're going to take our own lives.
Doesn't that information, when it in an accident situation, especially when there's been a fatal crash, regardless who did it, all that goes through the insurance companies and goes through the state to the DMV, and that does end up becoming public information?
No, even though there was not necessarily. I mean, the autopsies are routinely never given to anyone. I've tried as a reporter in very high profile cases to get a copy of an autopsy. Of somebody, say, who's a murder victim, or maybe even somebody who's a murderer. You cannot get autopsies unless they're released by the people who have them. The state won't do it. If the family happens to have a copy, they could give up a copy. For instance, in Ferguson, Missouri, when Michael Brown was shot to death, his family chose to bring in a top-notch forensic examiner. They did an autopsy, and the family released it because of all the controversy that was going on. But no, most of the rest of that information is not going to be available. And they're going to say anything that had anything to do with an autopsy will not be released. Anything that had to do with the family's contact with Child Protective Services is not going to be released. So even after the fact, I don't think we're going to find out much. And I think somebody should. Somebody should find out, was the state of Oregon aware of any problems in this family when they were living in the state 4 years ago and with these children? And what was done to background these two women before they adopted these children? And apparently all of that stuff is going to stay locked up tight.
One last thing, that situation where when the police officer was speaking about the suggestion that he said, well, you destroyed evidence.
Oh, the swallowing heroin to avoid a trip to jail. Yep.
That's a pretty major deal where some of the police departments will draw blood.
Well,
sometimes
but here's the problem. If you tell them you just swallowed a packet of heroin, if the packet hasn't been breached yet, do you know what you're going to find in the guy's system? Nothing. Until the heroin comes out of that package. So if it's a balloon, his stomach acid will typically take it apart. A lot of drug mules make that mistake of thinking, I can swallow 20 balloons and they'll survive until they go out the other end. And it doesn't happen. Sometimes the balloons pop. Sometimes they use condoms. Sometimes they use glassine packets. So until the heroin is released into their system, into their gut, you're not going to find anything in their blood. So a blood test isn't going to prove anything. And if they take the man or woman to jail, and in fact, it just happened again today. I just heard from an officer that it's happened yet again. So now we have some dirtbag criminal in a hospital bed being paid for by us, who may or may not have swallowed heroin, and we have a police officer tied up for the rest of a shift doing nothing except babysitting this jerk.
Well, I understand, and I know, by the way, I appreciate you being there, appreciate everything that you're
involved with. It's my pleasure. I just get very frustrated with these criminals and what they do, the ways they've found to game the system. Ron's on the line. Hey, Ron, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. Hey, Ron. All right, let's go to Brahim. Hey, Brahim, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, I want to talk about these Chinese tariffs. You know, China's not going to win this war. And if they're battling against Trump, they're going to lose this war hands down.
Agreed.
You know, it's time for America pride here. We need to build the stuff we need here. I don't know about you, but everything I buy is made in China. They pay these people pennies on the dollar. They're taking advantage of everyone. And now they're throwing crap at us, saying we're the problem. No, they're the problem.
I would agree with you. And by the way, who needs who the most? Because in a debate over who's going to win a particular contest, let's say you really, really need a place to live and you go down to rent one and the guy who's renting the apartment has 100 other people who'd like to rent his apartment. Who needs who the most? You need the landlord the most. In this case, who needs who the most? Does China need us more as a marketplace to sell
absolutely
their stuff?
Yeah,
or do we need them more? I would say we are in the driver's seat on this one. China is going to do what they can, and I think they're going to lose because they're dealing with Donald Trump. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'll get back to your phone calls and emails shortly at 866-439-5277. One of my big concerns has always been that in the states where marijuana has been made legal, that they haven't considered some of the other unintended side effects, or they've ignored them, that some of that pot that's grown will end up being shipped out of state to other parts of the United States. There are, in fact, a number of states where this is happening. Oregon knows, because of a report from its state police, that while there's about a third of $1 billion worth of marijuana legally sold in the state and taxed and all that, there's about $1 billion worth of pot just from one state that's being shipped out. And I've invited the DEA Special Agent Cam Strom to join me today. Special Agent Strom, it's a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me.
So what do we know about this, and what is the DEA doing about it?
DEA continues to investigate all the crimes associated with the Controlled Substance Act. Marijuana is one of those drug classifications, and we have ongoing investigations where Oregon marijuana is found in other states. Many of those investigations are the illegal distribution of marijuana, but there's also related crimes related to money laundering and organized crime and everything else that goes with it.
Is there a way to characterize how widespread this is from one state to the rest of the country?
I don't think there is. Any black market commodity is hard to get good empirical data on. We know from our investigations that marijuana grown in Oregon is found in a lot of other states, and in many of those instances, investigations are started in other jurisdictions that lead investigators back to Oregon to conclude their investigations.
I mean, there are times where you find out from the folks that are caught by either local police or by DEA agents where they obtained the original drugs, and there are probably times when you don't. Do they sometimes volunteer? Yeah, I bought this stuff in Oregon.
Either they volunteer that information or our follow-up investigation of the seizures in other jurisdictions leads it back to Oregon.
How much? I mean, there's no way to say how much you've seized or where it's been seized.
There's no way to know how much is going out of the state of Oregon. We could certainly, with an arduous task, determine how much has been seized and where. The last report I read, which was probably more comprehensive than the statistics I keep, had marijuana grown in Oregon found in at least 30 other states.
at least 30 other states. That's that sounds more like there's more of an effect from the one state of Oregon growing it than perhaps any other state in America. Is that fair to say?
I couldn't make that statement. I don't know what the other states are dealing with, so it's hard for me to say that.
Very good. Now, are you aware that people are flying in and then obtaining marijuana in some ways, managing to have it transported back? And is the transport going by air? Is it going by ground? Do you know?
I think like any other illicit substance, controlled substance like marijuana, the means of transportation are vast and are only controlled by your imagination. It's planes, trains, automobile. It's common carrier, it's, you know, postal service, it's UPS, it's FedEx, it's any way you can think of that these trafficking organizations will use to get any controlled substance into or out of the state.
Is the DEA focusing on Portland International Airport as one means that illicit buyers are coming in to obtain it?
I wouldn't characterize it as focusing on Portland International Airport. I think we focus on a number of transportation routes, whether it be train station, bus station, airport, a personal vehicle, anything, any conveyance is a way for drugs to get into or out of and money to get into or out of the state. And so we spend our energies focusing on all of those as it relates to the drug trafficking organizations that transship or use Oregon as a starting point or an ending point.
Are you finding, though, is there a real ability to interdict stuff that with somebody came into the state, let's say, flew in and wanted to buy here to take back to what the place they consider their home? Is there an ability to interdict this stuff if they've packed it in their checked luggage?
So DEA focuses on the organizations. I'm sure there are other entities and other interdiction efforts that we may not fully engage in that could give you a better answer on that. I know there are efforts, and I know we're involved. DEA in Oregon is involved in efforts at the airport and train station and bus station with our partners, both federal, state, local, and tribal partners, to remove or take away the cash that's intended for the purchase of marijuana, and then also make efforts to interdict that marijuana leaving the state.
I'm talking to DEA agent Cam Strom, Special Agent Cam Strom. So you're actually finding some people who are flying in with large amounts of cash that you believe they intend to use to purchase marijuana here and then get it back to the place they're going back to?
Certainly, but this isn't anything new. Oregon produces a lot of marijuana, and much like other states having other issues or foreign countries bringing controlled substances into the United States, the efforts are the same.
But is it, when you say it's nothing new, has it changed since the advent of legalized pot in both Oregon and Washington?
I don't know that it has or has not changed. I couldn't put a dial on legalization being a cause or effect. I just don't know.
So
it's really, that's a state issue. DEA has always continued to identify and target and investigate those trafficking organizations. Marijuana being one of the drugs, but we spend a considerable amount of time on the opioid families and methamphetamine and cocaine as well.
I guess what I'm hearing is that it sounds as though this $1 billion that the state police in Oregon have estimated is leaving the state, some of it may be leaving through PDX.
I don't have information or evidence or intelligence that indicates that, but like I said, it's certainly possible, just like it could be leaving on the train or leaving on the buses.
Well, I know you don't want to give away any of the tricks that these druggies, the ones that are doing this illicitly, are using. But if, for example, somebody packs marijuana into a suitcase and they've bagged it so that the smell isn't apparent, is it likely to be detected when that checked luggage is scanned at PDX, or is it likely to go undetected?
And like you just mentioned, I'm not in a position to provide you or anybody that's interested in learning how we do our business with any of the tricks of the trade or the tradecraft of how we conduct our investigations or work with our partners to further those investigations.
Well, I want you to catch them, so believe me, I'm on your side on this. But Special Agent Strom, is there anything else people need to know about what's going on in the Pacific Northwest region, as it apparently has become a major dope supplier, pot supplier to the rest of the country? Anything else we need to know to understand the scope and the nature of this?
We continue DEA throughout the country and worldwide continues to investigate in an effort to disrupt and dismantle the drug trafficking organizations worldwide. Marijuana in Oregon has certainly been in the spotlight recently, but we continue to deal with and investigate those organizations bringing heroin and methamphetamine and cocaine into the state, and they are just as impactful in the community, if not more impactful, than any other drug classification.
Do you think that because not only has pot been legalized, but now harder drugs, cocaine, heroin and methamphetamine have now been defelonized, not entirely decriminalized, but defelonized. Does that mean that with the reduction in emphasis at the local police level, is that making it harder for DEA to do its job?
I don't know that it's making it any harder. DEA doesn't, you know, we don't target drug users. We don't target those affected by addiction. DEA's mission has been, and for as long as I've been involved with it, is to identify those organizations that are preying on the addicted and exploiting the availability and the desire. And we target those organizations that are bringing, you know, drugs into the state and out of the state if appropriate, and try and bring those to the, you know, to justice with our partners at the U.S. Attorney's Office.
Very good. Special Agent Strom, it's a pleasure. Thank you very much for what you and your fellow agents do, and we appreciate the time today.
Thank you very much.
You bet. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get your calls at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. And by the way, naysayers go to the head of the line. You know, I love it when you can start a Monday with some really, really good news. And I just threw this up on our Twitter account, at Lars Larson Show, because I think that, to use a $5 phrase, Donald Trump has changed the dominant paradigm of the Middle East. And here's the latest example, the latest evidence of that. Mohammed bin Salman, who was the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, he was just in the Pacific Northwest last week, and we talked about that with Corwin Hake. He has just recognized Israel's right to exist, and he talks of future ties. This is from the Times of Israel. They say Mohammed bin Salman tells Atlantic the Iranian Ayatollah is worse than Hitler because he's trying to conquer the world. Now, this is a change in the Middle East. I think this is fantastic news. In a published interview, published today, he recognized Israel's right to exist and extolled the prospect of future diplomatic relations between his kingdom and the Jewish state. In an extensive interview with The Atlantic's Jeffrey Goldberg, Prince Mohammed laid out his vision for the future of the Middle East, including the possibility of cooperation with Israel. If you've been following the Middle East at all, you know how very significant this is. You know that the Palestinians, you know, these dozens and dozens of folks either on the West Bank or in the Gaza Strip, the ones that were rioting just last week in an offensive so bad that a number of them were shot to death simply because they can't respect the border of their neighbor. Does that sound familiar to you? The border of your neighbor. You respect your neighbor's border. If you live in an apartment, you respect the people next door and down the hall. If you live in a home, you respect the people on the other side of the fence. But up till this point, an awful lot of the Middle East has not been willing to do that. The Palestinians, as one of the conditions for getting anything done in the Middle East, have said, we will not recognize Israel's right to exist. In other words, they want to stick to the old tune that says they will only be happy when every Jew has been driven into the ocean. That's the position of the Palestinians. It was going all the way back to Yasser Arafat. Now you've got a very influential guy who seems to be getting an awful lot of attention from the entire world. And of course, he had this visit to the United States, the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who is saying, I'll recognize Israel's right to exist. I'll even tell my Arab brothers, I'm looking forward to maybe being able to cooperate with them on some things. I think that at some point, the Palestinians and the Gazans and all the other folks who want every single last Jewish person dead, they want the state of Israel to be wiped off the map. And in most of their countries, if you open up a school textbook, it's not even on the map. It would be like the United States saying Canada doesn't exist, except that Canada is gigantic. And Israel, a few hundred miles long. Its widest point, 51 miles. Its narrowest point, 9 miles. And yet somehow the existence of that little state and the people in it sticks in the craw of an awful lot of the mad mullahs. And to call the mad mullahs of Tehran the leaders of Iran, he says that they're behaving like the Nazis, like Hitler, that they want to take over the world. He says Israel's a big economy compared to their size, and it's a growing economy, something that can't necessarily be said about a lot of the Middle East states. And they must realize that when North America drilled for oil, when the United States allowed drilling for oil, even during the dark years of the Obama presidency, we became the Saudi Arabia of North America. And they realize that their influence on the rest of the world, which is largely based on oil, is going to be declining. So they have to figure out a way to get along. Anyway, let's go to your calls now at 866-439-5277. First to Travis. Hey, Travis, welcome.
Hey, Lars, this is Travis. You made a comment about pot being smuggled out of PDX airport.
Yeah.
I would more likely think it would be out of, like, the post office, because if I were a criminal, I wouldn't want to have it tied to me. I could just put any old address and send it out to anywhere in the country versus having it packed on me, have it tied to me somehow in some way, somewhere in where it gets delivered.
Unless you're assuming that the cops don't care about it.
Well, I assume the Unabomber sent bombs.
Yeah, but the Unabomber was sending bombs. What do you think is the current attitude of most law enforcement in Oregon or Washington about pot?
Very lenient.
Yep. Because it's legal. And even the illegal stuff is almost de facto legalized because they say, why even bother? Obviously, the political leadership of Oregon and Washington think that pot is no big deal, and they'd like to make their taxes on it. And you're probably right. That's one of the reasons I was asking the gentleman from the DEA, who didn't seem inclined to say, well, if you're sending it in your checked luggage, we're going to catch it because it goes through an X-ray machine. I'd be willing to bet the reason he wouldn't answer it is because there probably are people who fly into Portland, they buy a bunch of pot, which, it sounds like you've got some experience in the business. Is that right?
Well, I grew up in a family where my dad raised me in kind of the wrong way, and then I slowly grew out of that lifestyle.
So he was a drug user?
He tended to, like, he believed in making money.
By doing what?
By doing illegal activities.
Mm-hmm. Including pot or meth or what?
Yeah, it was pot.
Mm-hmm.
Mainly.
Well, just say it. And do you do that now?
No, I do not. Okay. I don't agree with his views anymore. I mean, he's gotten a lot of trouble. I found a stable job for myself and found out it's a lot easier just to keep it straight and narrow than go to jail every now and then, you know what I mean?
Did your dad have, during the time you were growing up, did he have any kind of real job other than growing and selling pot?
Yes.
What did he do?
He was an arborist or did concrete work most of the time. And then, like, on the side, he would sell marijuana and, you know, like, try to make some money to keep ahead of the game. I don't know.
Did he smoke it as well?
Did I? In high school,
no, did
yes.
he? Did your father?
No, he did not. He did not.
He actually grew pot but didn't consume it.
No, he did not consume it.
Okay. Well, you may be right. I have a feeling the reason he mentioned common carriers, which means UPS, FedEx, DHL, etc., those are other shipping companies. I have a feeling a lot of it gets shipped that way. Some of it may end up in automobiles and driven to places. But imagine this. The Northwest has now become the supplier illegally of over $1 billion worth of pot to 30 different American states, even though those states have not chosen yet to legalize it, which I find offensive because you're saying we're going to take pot into a place where the local population, the local voters have not yet decided to legalize it. Thanks for the story, Travis. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I got an interesting email from a gentleman, now unsigned. There's no name on here, but U Spy Uglies, I guess, is the name of the person who's writing to me. And he says, why are you so huffy puffy about Oregon marijuana being exported to other states without taxation? Trump has put the hammer to suffering middle and lower class people who seek to use the drug for their own well-being. Shut the hell up. He also thinks I'm on a different radio station. So I'm guessing that if you have too much of the weed, that you probably you lose some of that detail stuff. And it's not about taxation. It's about doing it within the law. The fact is, more than $1 billion is leaving just one state in the Northwest illegally. And it's leaving in a whole manner of different ways. And the DEA is now after it. Why? Not because it's not taxed, because it's illegal to do that. Let's go to Dwayne, who's a naysayer. Hey, Dwayne, you know how much I love naysayers. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, thanks for taking the call. I really appreciate listening to your show.
My pleasure.
Number one, the $1 billion leaving the state. I'm curious where that number comes from.
The Oregon State Police and the DEA did a report that the governor tried to keep secret because she's a friend of the marijuana crowd. She's taken a lot of money politically from the marijuana crowd. And when they came out with a report from the Oregon State Police, what better source to look at for what do they estimate the size of this problem is? The Oregon State Police said $1 billion. So they sell a third of $1 billion in the state legally, and then they ship three times that amount illegally to other states in America that have not yet decided and may never decide to legalize pot. Do you think that's a problem?
Yeah, I believe that's a criminal act.
Yep.
And I believe that the state of Oregon also would tell you that that's a criminal act.
Yep.
And I believe that that's the way our laws are written. I don't believe the state of Oregon has given anyone permission to take anything outside of the state.
Sounds like we agree. What do we disagree about since you're a naysayer?
What we disagree on is what I'm pretty sure I just heard the person, the representative from the DEA, say that there was no way to put a number on how much black market material or monies are leaving the state. So I would have a hard time seeing how anybody could come up with a factual number for black market product leaving the state.
Well, when I asked him how much is going out, he said he doesn't know, but the Oregon State Police have done a study of it, and they actually pulled in resources not just from their agency but others, and they say they believe that's the number. If you don't believe that's the number, tell me a better place to get the number than the state cops.
Yeah, well, I actually just don't. I don't feel like there is a place where we could get an accurate number.
Let's say it's
that.
$2 billion, or let's say it's a half a billion. Let's just say it's a big, big problem. What do we do about it?
What we do about it is we continue to pursue criminals taking things outside the state. I mean, that's, again, I guess what we disagree on is it's not the new market within the state of Oregon that's causing this to be a new issue.
No, I disagree with you there.
Oregon has always produced.
Oh, sure they have, but here's the difference. The difference is it used to be illegal to grow it at all. Then it was legal to grow it for so-called medical purposes, and they did, but they also produced a lot of excess. So anytime you allow people to do something 100% legally, that is grow it and then sell it under a legal mechanism, then you're going to provide a camouflage for anybody who's doing it illegally, because it used to be if you're growing it at all, you're breaking the law and you stood the chance of running into the cops. Now, when you run into the cops, you say, yeah, I'm doing it for medical. I'm doing it for a bunch of friends who've got diseases. And you have a pretty good cover for doing it illegally, right?
But that's also the only way to regulate it, isn't it?
Well, no, there is no regulation of it right now to speak of. The Oregon Liquor Control Commission just announced last week that they're going to start going out and doing some regulation. They do not. I've had Josh Marquis on before, the prosecutor friend of mine, who points out that while all hash oil extraction is supposed to be done under a state license, there are more than 100 hash oil businesses that aren't registered yet because the state hasn't kept up in regulation with all the businesses out there. In fact, when they first made it legal, it was supposed to become legal on the 1st of January of that year, of the next year. They said, well, people want to buy it now. Let's start on October 1st. And the objection was, hold on, we don't have any of the regulatory apparatus set up to do that. And you say, oh, that's all right. Let's just start selling it. We'll regulate it later. Well, later has now stretched out a long, long ways to the point where there are people who are selling it who don't have any legal right to sell it, but the state isn't enforcing any of that. What do you think that message means?
Well, I think that would be a bad message to send. I don't know that that's the one that we're trying to send. I believe that this is a new industry that I feel like it's brand spanking new. There is no model set up for how to regulate
something
like this.
Hold up. Dwayne, how old are you?
Some of that. You have,
Dwayne, okay. How old are you?
30.
Do you ever drink whiskey?
Very little, but yes.
Where do you get the whiskey?
At the liquor store.
And who's the only entity entitled to run a liquor store?
In Oregon, the state of Oregon.
Yeah, and the only place you can buy whiskey, the liquor store can't even buy it from the producers. There's a little distillery down in Cannon Beach, Oregon, that produces the liquor. It cannot walk a case of liquor two blocks down the street to the state liquor store. It all has to go to a central warehouse. It all has to be checked in. And then it has to be checked out and sent all the way back to a store that is two blocks from the distillery. Why? Because they have an entire system that's been in place for more than 100 years for regulating that controlled substance. So when you say, oh, this is brand new, we've never had anything like this before, I would beg to differ and say we have had for over 100 years state-controlled liquor in both Oregon and Washington. Now, Washington loosened up a little bit, and you can now buy it at the grocery store, the pharmacy, or whatever. But in Oregon, it is still a 100% state-regulated business, and you say they had to go out and reinvent the wheel to figure out a way to regulate a controlled substance. Well, I don't think so, because every bottle
maybe
of booze...
There's growing pains with all of these things, and none of the state-controlled liquor systems were set up overnight. Yes, I agree that...
No, but there's the model for it. There's how you do it. You say...
Right. You're right.
From the point...
We're having a problem with how fast these things are being implemented. I believe that there were four people last year to come down to the southern half of Oregon to go around and regulate...
You're making my case for me. You're saying that...
Well, because we agree on some things. Yeah. I listen to your show, Lars.
No, and I appreciate that, but when you tell me they don't know how to set up a system for... They do. They know. They have a system already in place to regulate how controlled substances are sold. And do you know what they've chosen not to do? They've chosen, said, yeah, we'll get to that somewhere down the line, because really...
How would that benefit them to wait and let people sell things illegally and on the black market? That doesn't help their situation.
I can tell you.
I think it does. Typical government, they can't figure out how to spend their money or where to spend money efficiently. So all the money that comes in from our liquor-run agency, there's nothing. Where is the extra money supposed to come from?
Dwayne, you're thinking money is the only currency we're dealing with here, right?
As far as the enforcement is concerned.
Oh, no. Hold on. Think about this broadly for a second. Who's the top elected official in the state?
Kate Brown.
Yep. She's the governor. You think she'd like to stay governor?
Yes.
You think an awful lot of the people who vote for her or will vote for her or might not vote for her are either users of pot or they're friendly toward the idea even if they don't use it themselves? Now, she got hundreds of thousands of dollars from the industry for her election campaign and reelection campaign. So did the Attorney General, Ellen Rosenblum. So do you think if you have the governor and the Attorney General, who may not care about getting the money directly, but they want to keep their jobs, do you think they're more likely to keep their jobs by cracking down hard on that industry, or they're less likely to keep their jobs if they crack down hard?
That one's tough for me.
Is it that tough? Let me imagine a world. This isn't going to happen, but imagine a world where Kate Brown comes out and says, we got $1 billion worth of stuff illegally using the state. I'm ordering the state police to crack down on pot. How much does that increase or decrease her chances of getting reelected?
I'll be honest with you. I don't think that would be the make or break issue for her.
Do you remember when they voted on pot legalization? It passed overwhelmingly, didn't it?
Yes.
And it had a lot of votes from people who didn't smoke pot, but they were friendly toward the idea. How are all those voters going to react to a candidate, a sitting governor, who says, I'm going to crack down on this. I'm not letting this happen anymore. How are they going to react?
Well, I think the reason why the numbers and the percentages of voters that became okay with this is because everybody's looking, maybe too idealistically, but I think there's a lot of citizens that would like to see this be something that could be regulated properly.
But why would you regulate it properly when that costs a lot of money? It also has the chance to put a lot of people who you otherwise agree with in jail. You don't want to do that.
It's your responsibility, and I don't think the voters that voted for marijuana legalization, people that actually go out and vote, it wasn't the growers, it wasn't the potheads, it wasn't people that wanted to make money off of an illegal industry or a legal industry. It was citizens who wanted to stop seeing people get locked in prison over marijuana.
Nobody got locked in prison over marijuana. You know that. We've done the numbers.
How can you even say that?
We've done the numbers. The number of people who are actually in the Oregon prison system who've ever been locked up, other than huge quantities. If you're caught with huge, you know, you're shipping hundreds of pounds, you might go to federal prison, you might go to state prison. But for the most part, I think the number we had during the campaign was 14,000 people had got a ticket for possession of pot. And of those, 100 people had actually gone to jail, even, you know, been taken into custody. The rest of them were just given a ticket. Cost of doing business. You paid a fine and you were done with it. So that, and that was before legalization. After legalization, the police spend very little time focused on that because they know their bosses don't want them to do much with it. And if you think Kate Brown takes her legal responsibility seriously, you're aware that Oregon has a death penalty, right?
Yes.
Does Kate Brown take that seriously?
I'll be honest with you. You can't get me into a position where I'm trying to support Kate Brown.
Well, all I'm saying is if you think she takes her responsibility seriously, you should look at her actions. I look at what people say and what people do. And what she says and what she does not tell me that she takes the law seriously. She takes the laws she likes and enforces them. She takes the laws she doesn't like, and she just gives them a pass. And I think in this case, I think she thinks there's a tremendous political advantage to just saying, I'm not going to do anything about it. In fact, she tried to hide that state police report. She fought against its release, and once it got released, she said the report has the wrong number in it. She asserted it had the wrong number. And when folks said, well, what's the right number? She said, I don't have a right number, but the number that came from her state police department, she declared to be a wrong number without saying the number is actually either bigger or smaller. I think, you know, I understand you don't support Kate Brown. I don't either. I think she's a terrible governor right now. But she's still invited on the show anytime she wants to come on, if she has the courage to make some decisions and answer some questions. Back in a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. I find it subtly ironic that the University of Oregon is using a brand new way to get the attention of prospective college students. The Register Guard says that the Eugene-based university, as part of its latest recruitment effort, UO360, is sending out cardboard virtual reality goggles to all domestic undergraduate students that they've accepted. In other words, the university is finally admitting what a lot of us have known to be true for a good long time. That is that the university, like a lot of American universities, exists in a bubble of virtual reality made of cardboard. Let's go to Danny in Enterprise. Hey, Danny, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today?
Hi, Mr. Larson. I'll make it quick for you. When I heard Mr. Benson earlier, I know you have contact with him. I would like him to consider pulling a sample, say 1 or 2% of draft registration, and just running them through basic training and seeing how that works out. Because from what I'm hearing, they're not that good anymore.
Actually, the military branches have said they're not that good anymore. They have said that an awful lot of recruits are showing up incapable of doing what you need to do to be able to fulfill military service. That is, they've had to look. They have kids who didn't grow up throwing a football or throwing a baseball or throwing a javelin or a shot put, and they can't throw a grenade the required distance that they would have expected. Absolutely. Kids from previous. Now, the problem is, it's not the job of Selective Service to force a return of the draft. That would take an act of Congress. You don't really want to bring back the draft, do you? I like the all-volunteer military.
No, sir. I would much prefer the draft. I was a 17-year-old kid from Oklahoma. I never even met a black man until I got into the Army.
And after 23 years in, I saw Vietnam, I saw Iraq. I have no problem with reinstating the entire draft.
Well, but tell me this. Don't you think the military is better today as an all-volunteer force? Everyone is there because he or she signed up for it, right? How would it be better if we corralled people into doing it when we have volunteers who are willing to do it because they love the idea of serving their country?
When the military starts building up, I think you're going to see a problem with that. But, again, that's just me, and that's from experience.
I got to tell you something. My honest belief is that when people signed up for the military, my dad signed up, he was not drafted. My mom signed up, she was not drafted. My father-in-law signed up, he was not drafted. Why? Because they decided that they wanted to serve their country. I want everyone who puts on that uniform to sign up voluntarily to serve their country.